Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
In 1993, a teenager contacted police in Utah to report the murders of her two sisters almost a decade earlier. The alleged perpetrator, their own mother. The investigation that followed uncovered a sadistic, tyrannical matriarch who had subjected her daughters to a lifetime of verbal, psychological, and physical abuse, ending in 2 torture murders you would not wish on your worst enemy, let alone your children. This is what happens when a mother's love is replaced by pure evil. This is the case of Teresa Knorr. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's get on with today's case. So let's go back to 1993, because this is essentially where it begins and begins to unfold, shall we say. So we've got 16-year-old Terry Knorr, and she contacts Utah police. And the reason that she does that is she says that she's got this information about 2 unsolved murders, one almost 10 years earlier that had happened in 1984, and the other that had occurred in 1985, so the year later. And she said, not only do I know about these 2 murders, I know who the victims are. The victims are my 2 older sisters. And not only do I know who the victims are and how they're related to me, I also know that the person responsible for their deaths is my mum. Now, you would imagine that anybody walking into a police station with such information would be taken seriously. It's really unusual for people to walk in to the authorities and lie. It happens, of course it does, but very rarely. And certainly not with this kind of intimate and intricate information, bearing in mind she knows the victims, that would be easy to check out. And secondly, she knows the perpetrator, which means that she is a living witness against this person. But no, they decide that they're not going to take any of Terry's concerns seriously. Which is terrifying, because what message does that give to an individual who is a witness and by proxy is also a victim in these situations? But it's not just the police that don't take her seriously. She's speaking to a therapist at the time, and Terry's concerns are not taken seriously there either, which is reprehensible and goes against the ethics of any mandated reporter. If you come to see me and you tell me that you're aware of 2 homicides and you know who is actually responsible for that homicide, I would have to report that. It's part of our contracting when we have a client relationship. We make sure that they're aware that safeguarding procedures mean that at times we will breach and break confidentiality, and this would meet the bar at the highest level. But she doesn't give up. And that's testament to Terry, because even though no one in her direct line, such as a therapist, is taking her seriously, or the police, who are meant to be there to protect us, are taking her seriously, she doesn't want to let this go. It's burning within her. It's burning and staining her conscience. So instead, she ends up calling the hotline for the Fox television program America's Most Wanted. And at this point, they're really helpful. And they advise her to contact the police in Placer County, California, because that's where Terry claimed that the first body had been dumped. Terry was able to give a really detailed description of her sister's murder to Placer County detectives. And of course, because it's so detailed, and because these are professionals who actually are taking her seriously, because it's worth investigating, even if somebody is a fantasist, investigate first. And they do their due diligence, and they're able to link that unidentified body of a young woman that they'd found all those years before to exactly what Terry is saying. I mean, up until then, the body that they'd found was Jane Doe, #4873/84. That was the only way she was known. They had discovered the body of that Jane Doe still smouldering. Basically, she'd been dumped by the side of a road and she'd been set on fire. So finally, after all these years, after such depravity, and also such a lack of respect that they'd never even been able to name this body, She was just burning bones, essentially. Finally, they're able to put that name to this mysterious Jane Doe. Now, Terry said, look, this is my older sister, Susan Marlene Knorr. When they start to investigate these now very powerful and seemingly authentic claims, it just begins to unfold what can only be described as years and years of systematic child abuse perpetrated by, I think we can name her, deranged and sadistic as a mother, which is Teresa Knorr. Because the way that she treats her children, and I'll go into detail during this particular video, it is indescribably despicable. It is almost impossible to imagine a mother who basically is there to protect her children failing them so despicably. Let's look at what forms Teresa Jimmy Francine Knorr. So she's born 1946, Sacramento, California. She was the daughter of Jim Cross. He's James Jim Cross, but he's known as Jim. He was an actual assistant cheesemaker, and also her mum was Swanee Gay. Apparently her mum was just devoted. She was also a pencil maker. So they both had professions, they both worked. Now, when Knorr was a child, things did become complicated. So her father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And unfortunately, as happened many decades ago, what we would say about the medicality of these kind of conditions is that sometimes people were given operations that weren't necessarily, shall we say, sophisticated enough to occur at the time. And as opposed to them being helpful to the issue in this particular situation, a brain disease such as Parkinson's, it actually becomes more problematic. So he has this unsuccessful brain surgery and it just totally changes his character. So he becomes really depressed. And apparently what also changed is the way that he would treat Knorr and her mother. So he went from being a relatively devoted person to the family to actually getting really angry, being really frustrated and taking it out on her and her mum. And anybody who's listening who's had a brain injury and then suffered from some kind of personality changes, you'll be absolutely acutely aware of how this can play out. For those of you who don't know, very often we see in serious brain surgery or serious brain injury that because of the interference with certain areas of the brain, it can disturb the original character and personality and bring forth, shall we say, more problematic behaviours in the people that we love. And that can be very confusing for people around them because you have a relationship with one person, they come out of hospital or they come out of recovering from an injury, and even though they look exactly the same, the way that they act can be very, very different. And you kind of have to say to yourself, well, is this where one of the big fractures begins? Is this where the laying the foundations of the monster that Knorr would later become begins to thrive, essentially? Now, this situation is further compounded. She's 16 at the time when she has another really life-challenging event. So she's incredibly close to her mother, and unfortunately her mum dies of heart failure. And she doesn't just die of heart failure, she collapses completely suddenly and out of the blue, and she dies in Knorr's arms. Now, at 16 years of age, you are not prepared or capable of managing such a situation. It is a blindsiding event. It completely capsizes your world. Psychologically, it means that your go-to individual is no longer there to go to. And that's not just on an emotional level, that's physically the presence of them just disappearing. So we can have complete sympathy and empathy for Knorr at this moment in time. She's been dealt some really tragic, really challenging blows. And understandably, it sends her into a deep depression. One of the big things that shifts as well is that her mother was responsible at this point, because obviously her father had got the issues that I've already outlined. She's bringing in the money for the family. He can't work. So now they're in a situation of complete economic decline, and following her mother's death, they actually have to sell the family home. It's the world that Knorr was living and experiencing, the world that she had known in spite of its issues, just fell apart. And at 16, how are you going to manage those feelings? How are you going to deal with the psychological uncertainty and, of course, the compounded grief that you're dealing with. And she's kind of grieving two people, because she's grieving Dad in the fact that he isn't the person that she knew and loved early on, because he's changed because of what happened to him. And then we have a complete absence of the woman that made her feel safe. Now, it doesn't surprise me that it doesn't take very much time at all for her to meet her first husband. So she meets a guy called Clifford Clyde Sanders. This is just after a few months of getting together. They actually get married. She's only 16. So this has all happened very, very fast. And you can imagine, can't you? You have lost your security. You've lost your foundation. You've lost your sense of what your world is like and what it was supposed to feel and be. And you're looking to cling on to something that makes you feel secure. You're 16. You have no idea how to sustain yourself. You have no support network around you now who can help sustain you. And then this guy walks in who's 21 years of age, which when you're 16 feels like a grown up. And as far as she's concerned, he swoops her off her feet, and suddenly she has an option for a new foundation. That would be incredibly alluring. And it would also make sense at 16 to cling on to that potential new opportunity. And she drops out of school pretty much immediately and very quickly gets pregnant. And she gets pregnant with her first child, who is born Howard Clyde Sanders in 1963. I would say that the marriage that we see between Nora and Clifford, it sets a precedent for the future, because it's really tumultuous. So there's constant jealousy, constant arguments. But again, that is quite contextual age-wise. When you are 16 and 21, you have not got the experience of relationships that you need to really have a foundation that's going to grow into something that is positive a lot of the time. Also, you're in a scenario where everything feels bigger, because you haven't necessarily had to deal with the responsibility roles and the exhaustion of what you meet when you're in your mid-20s, 30s, because life just throws lots of things at you. And it reduces the intensity that you feel towards certain scenarios that play out. Whereas when you're very young, everything can feel enormous. And we also have to remember that she's going through trauma at the same time. And that in itself is going to make the need to cling on to a sense of foundation even more pivotal, which means that the game is even more lodged against her in this moment, because whenever he does something that she feels could be an indiscretion or could lead to him leaving her, it's going to make her feel really insecure. And that can obviously lead to resentment and anger. Now, Noor was apparently very possessive, very controlling. She was constantly convinced that he was cheating on her, and that is completely contextual with what we would imagine when you think about where her mind is at this moment in time and her emotional attachment and the problems that have occurred. Of course, she's going to be terrified he's going to leave her. There was one occasion where Clifford spends the day drinking and he's been with his friends. He's arrived home late. He's very drunk, and she is absolutely furious with him. And they get into this very, very big arguments, and he allegedly punched her in the face, which is absolutely inappropriate. I mean, it doesn't matter how somebody goads you. The point is, you have a choice to make. And if you choose to punch your female partner in the face, that means you are a very violent individual. And obviously that means that that person is in a position of harm. At the same time, I think we can all agree that people are not the best people possible when they are highly inebriated. And picking a fight with somebody who's very drunk is probably not the best idea at any point. Now, she does go ahead and file charges, but she doesn't go through with them. We see that all the time in domestic violence situations. People do not like seeing through these kind of charges when they affect a partner, particularly if that partner is the person that you see as your main security. Now, ultimately, Clifford decides that she is not the woman for him. But unfortunately, he never gets to go through with that plan, because the night that he tells her, "I'm going," he was packing his bags, she shot him with a deer rifle. Bullet went straight through his left wrist, lodged in his heart, and it killed him. He was 23 years old at the time. Now, bear in mind, at this point, Noor is only 18, and she's even 7 months pregnant at the time with her second child. But somehow, in spite of the fact of basically cold-bloodedly murdering this man, she manages to avoid a murder conviction. So despite the fact that there wasn't actually a lot of evidence to say that this man that she'd married was this violent alcoholic who physically abused her. They just kind of went with it when she said it. So when she went to court, her argument was this was complete self-defense. I grabbed a gun whilst he was beating me, and then it just accidentally gone off. Now, in this day and age, it's highly unlikely that kind of a story would float. And the reason for that is ballistics experts and forensics are so effective at being able to see the way that a gun is used that the serious likelihood is she would have been caught and convicted. But back then, it was a lot more problematic. It was a lot more difficult to prove. So she gets acquitted at trial. And his family pretty much know she murdered him, but she gets away with it. Now, bear in mind, if you think about the psychology of being able to outsmart an entire legal system to get away with murder, it is going to do something to the way you conceive the world around you. First of all, you're going to imagine, I can get away with murder. I am brighter and better than these legal minds that are here to serve and protect us. And that pivotal moment in her development, I think, is why she ends up with this belief that she can indeed get away with murder. It is probably the seed that is planted that flourishes in to this incredible landscape, as far as she is concerned, where she gets to call the shots, both figuratively and literally. Now, obviously, she was 7 months pregnant when that happened. So she gives birth to a second child, Sheila Gay Sanders. And it seems like this is also the point where she starts to use alcohol. I can imagine that she was self-medicating with alcohol to deal with some of the difficult feelings that she was carrying around, the trauma of the losses of her parents. I don't know whether there is any conscience there about potentially the murder of her husband, but certainly she's trying to eradicate or anaesthetized some difficult feelings, and this drinking will be a feature in her life throughout. And it's not long, and it's unsurprising that the next move that she makes is she wants to get into a new relationship. So she meets a guy called Estel L. Thornsbury. Now, this guy's a disabled war veteran. I would say Noor is again looking for an opportunity to fix foundations, but she hasn't got the actual resources and emotional cogency required to actually be a good partner. And she isn't. So she gets with this guy, and instead of raising her two really young children, she feels it's far more fun to just spend her time drinking and partying. And Estelle, who's probably initially thought, oh, I've found a wife who's gonna take care of me and, I don't know, provide me with sustenance on a daily basis and tend to all of the issues that I've had from being a veteran. No, Estelle, you got that one wrong. She wasn't going for the trad wife opportunity. No, you ended up just having to look after the kids for days at a time. So again, we're not talking about a marriage of love. We're talking about a marriage of convenience and basically free childcare for her. And we are immediately introduced to the reality that she does not show her children nurture and care. She's quite happy to leave them with whoever will take them off her. So immediately we can see she is not this natural mother like her own mother was. And it doesn't take long. He gets really exhausted with her behaviour. And the final straw for him is when he discovers that she's having an affair with his best friend. And I can really relate to this because my first marriage ended when my husband was having a relationship with a very close friend of mine. If you really want to close the door on possibility and opportunity emotionally, that will really screw your partner over. Don't do it, kids. At the end of the day, just leave the relationship instead of screwing up all of the relationships involved. And I guess that he, like I, had got to a point where that boundary had been broken and those lovely, flexible boundaries that everybody thinks people have actually just turn out to be elastic, and the elastic snapped. So when he finds out that she's sleeping with his best friend, they separate. Now again, she moves on really quickly with a next relationship. This time it's with a guy who's a US Marine, Robert Noor. So he's 18 at the time. So these are very young. And just think about how she's traveling from relationship to relationship. This is not about love. This is not about meeting the right person. This is about Mr. Right now in these circumstances. So it doesn't take long. She's pregnant again, she's married again, she gives birth to her third child. Now, bear in mind how young she is at this point. So she's practically been pregnant since her mother died. And we can see that essentially this is how she's connecting with the guy that she's with. It's like impregnate, stay, at least it will give me some foundations. It fails every time, but nonetheless, at the end of the day, patterns get repeated. So she ends up giving birth to Susan Marlene Knorr. That was in September 1966. And three other children quickly follow. We get William Robert Knorr. That's in September 1967. Robert Wallace Knorr Jr. in December 1968. And Teresa, known as Terry Marie Knorr, which is in August 1970. Now, again, the marriage that she's in is one that has loads of conflict. It follows that same relationship pattern. And a lot of the conflict as well is fueled by the alcohol. She's again said to be very controlling, very possessive in the relationship. She was constantly convinced that Robert was cheating on her. And the physical abuse within the relationship was dual. So both she and Robert were very abusive towards each other. But we also see Knorr expanding that abuse, and she becomes really abusive to the children. And wow, the type of abuse that she inflicts on those kids, it's one of those things that, particularly for modern parents, it's impossible to conceive that anybody would ever think it was acceptable. So, for example, if they did something wrong and they didn't have to be big misdemeanors, she would force them to just sit for hours without moving. Now, if this even flinched, they'd be slapped or they'd be locked in a closet, which is truly terrifying. But the idea of young children just having to sit down and not move, and if they move, they get hit. I mean, it's almost impossible for children to sit still. It's not within their psyche. It's not within their psychology and makeup. It's the way that is complete opposite to a child experience. You're meant to be running around. You're meant to be expending energy. It's really difficult for children to sit in one place at one time. In fact, even in our education system, when we look at primary school children, so those aged between the ages of 4 to 11, it's incredibly difficult for them to sit down quietly for long periods of time. It's also probably why so many people get diagnosed with ADHD, because with respect, it's not actually attention deficit hyperactive disorder. It's probably more likely in a lot of cases that the kids just need to have a different system of learning. Sorry, that's my own views. Not everyone agrees with them, but having worked in this field for a long time, I definitely think we over-diagnose ADHD, and also that we understand, so to speak, what children need in their environments, and that is to be able to run wild, because that's part of what childhood is all meant to be about. So you can imagine how difficult that's going to be for her kids. Now, again, because there are so many problems in this relationship, Robert ultimately divorces her in 1971. Now, after their separation, Knorr actually prevented him from having any contact with the children whatsoever. We've got to remember that in 1971, if a mother took the children away, there were very few rights for a father, full stop. If she wanted to keep him away from the children, she would have been able to do that very, very easily. Some people would even say today that it's harder for a man to actually gain access to children if there is a parent who wants to alienate them and can get away with it to some degree if they know how to play the system. Not all. A lot of people feel it's weighted in the opposite direction as well. But what I'm trying to introduce is these kind of wounds from the past where men feel that they're not given the same kind of equality. They still do exist in certain scenarios and situations even today. Now, the very same year that she is divorced from that husband, she remarries. I mean, honestly, is it just me? I actually find it quite difficult to meet people that I even find vaguely attractive. That's just one of those things. You know, it's pretty hard, isn't it? Meeting somebody and falling in love with them. It's a difficult road. Well, unless you're a Hollywood A-lister and then they're just queuing up, aren't they? Celebrities just like have this conveyor belt, because obviously rich, attractive people are everywhere. But apart from those individuals, for the most part, us mere mortals, it is difficult to meet somebody that you connect with and that you can consider spending and sharing your life with. Not for her, no. She's like, just keep them coming. Just keep them coming. And railroad worker Ronald Pulliam, well, he's next on that track. Little did he know as he pulled in that carriage that he was meeting Miss Multidata, Multimarriage, Multifailure when it comes down to relationships. Girl of his dreams. But just as we've seen in the relationship with Estelle, she basically just spends the entire time that she's with him partying and drinking. Apparently she's a nightmare to live with, and it takes literally 1 year and Ronald divorces her. Should there not be some kind of situation where if you turn up, you know, going through another divorce after several divorces, that somebody's like, I'm afraid we're revoking your license to ever get married again? I mean, genuinely, like, if you get 9 points on your license in the UK or whatever, and you make a mistake, you're going to have your license taken off you for good reason, because you clearly should not be driving a car. Could it not be the same with marriage? You know, you just arrive at the courthouse to file to say that you want to get married, and somebody's just like, I'm really sorry, you're having a red card placed on your matrimonial opportunity. See, it's literally a red card. It's a red card so that we don't even have to go. We can just see. It's a no. It's a no. You can never get married again. But apparently, it's okay. Just keep getting married. But that divorce happens because she continues to live out these patterns. And there is obviously something psychologically fractured within her, because she constantly needs to be in a relationship. It doesn't matter how awful that track record is. It doesn't matter how many times it's reinforced that this is not the right way forward. She can't seem to get off that belief system that somehow if she marries somebody, she'll have something secure, even though she is the insecurity within the relationship. We get to 1976. I kid you not. She gets married again. Now, this time she gets married to 59-year-old Chester, known as Chet Harris. This is after, you'll want to know, should we have a guess, how many months, years before she actually meets and marries this guy? Well, I'll put you out of your misery, guys. It's not 1 month. It's not 12 months. It's not 2 years. It's not even a week. That's right. It's not even a week. I'm exaggerating quite astonishingly there, because it's not even half a week. It's just 3 days. I mean, if I haven't met somebody and within 3 days thought, this is the partner for me, we should probably go and immediately get married, I don't know what I'm doing on my day-to-day life. I mean, 3 days? Who was around this woman? Could you imagine your mate turning up, knocking on the door? Oh my God, I've got some news for you. Come on. Yeah, I've got got a new boyfriend. This is great. I'm really happy for you. I know. I met him 2 days ago. Wow. It's early. It's early days. Yeah, but he is definitely like marriage material. Yeah. Well, I mean, you've been with him 2 days, so you want to obviously consider how that will be in a year. Well, yeah, I mean, that sounds like a reasonable idea. But what I'm thinking is I'm going to marry them tomorrow. Okay. Haven't you had several failed marriages? And this is not like a pattern of behavior. It's getting worse, in fact, because you've never married anybody after 3 days. I know, but this one is it. It's absolutely 100% going to work. 100%. It's 98%. It's 64%. It's 12%. There's a slight percentage possibility, 0.0001%, that this might work. So I'm just going with it. Genuinely. 3 days after meeting him. And, you know, it's not just her that's the issue there. It's Chet Harris as well. Why are you making decisions based on this? This is a ridiculous time frame to decide that this is the woman for me and this is the man for me. What I would say about Chet Harris is that if ever there was a moment in time where her kids actually had the opportunity to have a father figure in their lives, this was the guy. So Susan in particular grows really close to Chester, but as opposed to Noor seeing this as a really positive thing and one that she really wanted to promote, which you would imagine, as having a new stepfather in their life is an opportunity for bonds to be bound and for connections to really strengthen, not for Noor. Noor was really jealous of their relationship. Now, she's jealous of their relationship because she obviously wants this intensity and she wants him to focus on her. But she also has those classic feelings that we've already seen in past relationships of envy and jealousy. Chester was a really keen photographer and he used to, for example, take consensual pictures of naked women. And that was something that Nora really couldn't tolerate. And again, I can have some degree of sympathy and empathy with somebody like Nora in this moment. A lot of women wouldn't necessarily feel that it's okay our husband having a hobby where he goes and takes pictures of beautiful naked women. Some of us, I don't know, may find that a little bit inappropriate. And also, is it really the only thing you can take photographs of? There's a spectrum, isn't there, of appropriate photography. Stop taking the nudes of women and go out and take nature photographs that we can then have printed and placed on our walls for everyone to see, unlike the naked women that you keep taking pictures of, because literally I can't show anybody that. And all I'm going to say is when the vicar found the album, he was interested, but I think he was also slightly offended, although he did spend quite a time flicking through. I don't know why I've brought a vicar into this. There is literally no reason whatsoever. I apologise in advance. Anyway, as my weird fantasies fly through my mind, it turns out that it really gets to her and the marriage ends after only 3 months. So good going. Those 3-day relationships that make you get married are probably something that we should all consider not doing. So following the breakdown of her 4th marriage, Nora actually moves into a cramped 2-bedroomed apartment in Sacramento. I think we can all have sympathy and empathy for the fact that being a single mum with a lot of children would be financially incredibly difficult. But it feels that because she has got so much pent up frustration, resentment, we can also add compounded grief to it, anger, that the abuse of her children, who to some degree have been a consistent in her life, let's be honest, they've always been present, this really intensifies the abuse. And specifically, it's the verbal, psychological and physical abuse that's directed towards her daughters. And you can say, well, why the daughters? Why not the sons? You know, at the end of the day, it feels like men have let her down, you know, from her father having problems with his personality change after the brain surgery, through to all of these men who haven't necessarily come through with the foundation of support and security that she feels that she deserves. Why then does she take it all out on her daughters? And I guess we could explore the potential of self-hate and a projection of seeing the daughters as an extension of who she is and feeling really bitter and resentful towards them, because when she considers her own female failures, she hates herself for the way that she's acted. She hates herself for the fact that her mother left her. And even though, of course, she didn't choose to, the sense of abandonment fuels that resentment. This may not be the case, but I suppose we can explore that as a possibility. She'd regularly beat them. She threw knives at them to test her aim. She would burn them with cigarettes. And disturbingly, she also got her boys to join in the abuse. So she was encouraging to her sons. Initially, she actually got her eldest son, Howard, to be a helper. But then soon after that, she got William and Robert. She enlisted them to also take part in this abuse. And it's reprehensible to imagine that any child would engage in that kind of behaviour. But again, when you are growing up, your parent or parents tend to be like gods. You do what they tell you on the whole. It takes a very sturdy personality, particularly in young children, to reject and refuse that. And they see what she's capable of. And if that perpetrator is capable of doing really horrible things to a sibling and you refuse to help them, you know that the consequence will probably be that you'll end up in a very similar predicament. And that's enough to obviously upset the emotion that ties you to your siblings and instead creates an allegiance and an alliance with the parent who's the predator. One of the things that Nora had was a 1-foot by 4-foot wooden board. And she actually scrawled onto that board, Board of Education. And that's clearly a reference to the fact that she sees physical violence as a way of educating children in their misdemeanors. The brothers would be enlisted to hold down the sisters, and then Nora would mercilessly beat them. And I mean mercilessly. It could last from anywhere between 5 minutes, which would be hell, to as long as half an hour. Can you imagine being hit by a board at force by an adult for up to half an hour whilst being held down by the very people that you feel you should be able to trust? Now, when Terry was 8, she actually recalled being locked in a freezer, literally in the freezer, incredibly dangerous. She's 8 years of age. How terrifying, how abandoning, how horrifying. And her mother and her eldest brother, Howard, they actually sat on the lid so she couldn't escape. And all she could think about while she was in there is, I'm gonna die. She was 8. Imagine placing a child in such a scenario where they cannot imagine they're ever gonna get out alive. And for any child, when your primary caregiver does something so reprehensible, it makes you terrified of your world, because they're the people that you go to for support. They're the people who go to for nurture. They're the people that you ask for in your darkest of moments. And they're the ones causing this agony. The psychological torture and distress that she must have experienced would have been blindsiding for her. There was another occasion as well when Noor's really drunk, as she is most of the time, and she actually puts a gun to Terry's head and threatens to shoot her. I mean, again, we're talking about a level of torture that an adult would struggle to come to terms with, let alone a developing child. And this is all they've known. So even though it's reprehensible, even though it's completely wrong, even though we can all look and observe and see how broken their environment is, as a child, when you are kept away from the rest of the world, and they're being kept away from the rest of the world, the truth is you don't have anything to compare it to. All you've known is dysfunction. You've known a lot of transition. You've learned lots of different men in your life. You've known nothing substantial security-wise. And the abuse that you are encountering and experiencing, it's normalized. It feels terrible, but you have no idea that this is happening to you and it's not happening to others. Your belief is, well, this is just the way things are. And that's so devastating to imagine these little kids growing up and thinking, well, this is just the way that families work. Now, even though the boys are actually made to help her in the abuse, I would say that they all were abused, so the boys did receive that. But the majority really was focused on her two eldest daughters, so that's Sheila and Susan. There is a lot of suspicion that the reason that she held and harboured this resentment towards them in particular was because of jealousy. I mean, they were turning into really attractive young women. She was, of course, getting older, and psychologically it can be really distressing as you realise that your visibility level drops. I think any of us women who've gone through our 20s and 30s, etc., you see visibility in a different way to when you're in your 40s, and you have to come to terms with the fact that it's okay, that youth is beautiful and that you get wisdom. So you're really kind of able, when you're older, to see the world in a different way and to grow into yourself. Whereas when you're younger, you have insecurities that are very far reaching a lot of the time, and you don't have the wisdom that you'll be afforded through the years. So it's a trade-off, but people do get really angry at letting go of beauty. And people do get very hurt by their invisibility as they get older. And it seems like this was a real trigger for her. Also, of course, she's been drinking constantly for years, so she's ballooned in weight, and a lot of people get very heavy bloating in the face. And like it or otherwise, that does affect the way that the world sees you. And of course, her young, youthful, beautiful girls, they're not suffering from those problems at all. She even would force feed them, because she just wanted to make them less and less attractive, ideally. So you can see that the abuse isn't just physical in an obvious way. It's the psychological, emotional, and social taunting that occurs, because she's very, very nasty about them as human beings to other people as well. So they're in this absolute prison of abuse on a daily level. And on one occasion, she does something really, really strange, but again, it's very much about affecting beauty. So she gets blind drunk, and then she plucks out all of her own eyebrows and eyelashes. Now, there is a condition called trichotillomania, and that is where people will kind of obsessively remove the hair. Some people will remove the hair from the head, literally to points where they've got bald patches everywhere, sometimes remove all the hair, same with eyelashes and eyebrows. There isn't evidence to suggest that she suffers with trick, but I think it's worth noting that that obsessive compulsive behaviour certainly seems to play out during this moment in time. It isn't indicative of something that she had consistently faced, but it certainly, in this case, when you think about her link with being desirable, would add to that self-hatred and loathing that she doesn't feel desirable now because she's removed something that is seen as a beautiful reality for women, which are our eyelashes and our eyebrows. She sobers up and she cannot believe that she has done this. So as far as she's concerned, she's got no memory at all of what she's actually done. So she gets the three daughters upstairs and she's got her eldest son, Howard, with her waiting for them. And because she has done this to herself and she's so incensed by her own behaviour, essentially, and she's clearly suspicious that even though this is certainly a kind of behaviour we'd expect to see from her, that her daughters have been present and maybe they did it, she goes ahead and just repeatedly burns each one of them with a cigarette on the back. And then this is all about saying to them, until one of you admits plucking them out, I'm going to keep doing this. Now, none of them admit it. I mean, they get abused every day of the week anyway. So why admit to something that they haven't done? You know, the punishment is going to be even more harsh, even more scary. So they don't admit because they didn't do it. But she decides, as far as she's concerned, it must have been Susan. And she said the reason that Susan had done it was because, as a mother, she's so pretty and Susan's really jealous of how pretty she is. So again, delusional beyond belief, but also a way of further punishing Susan for her own beauty, but trying to play it off as, well, it's because Susan thinks I'm so gorgeous and she wants to be me, which is probably something that Noor desperately wishes people would feel like, but they don't. Because she is long past her sell-by date because of the way that she has treated her body. It's as simple as that. At the time that all this was playing out, the kids all just thought this systematic abuse was normal. They saw it as just a way of disciplining children. They'd never known anything else. And apparently it was quite confusing because she was abusive most times, but there would be an odd day where she suddenly switched. So she'd be really kind, she'd be nurturing, she'd behave in their head and hearts as a mother should, but that would only be fleeting. Then she'd switch back, she'd beat them, she'd lock them in the rooms for days. And as young children, they just put up with this and accepted this was normal. But as they get older, they start to realise this behaviour isn't normal. The way this woman is treating us is not as a mother should. And they start to realise they are being abused. And again, the gravity of that would be huge for them. They've dealt with the most horrifying abuse for so many years, so much dysfunction, so much transition, and then suddenly the light bulb goes on. This is not acceptable. But of course, they've got no power. They've got no money. What can they do? And the worse Noor's drinking gets, the more she gains weight, the more reclusive she begins. So her world becomes smaller and smaller. And in keeping with her selfishness and egotistical beliefs, she actually isolates her children from the outside world. So she takes them away from everything that could potentially free them from this horrible situation, takes them out of school eventually, even disconnects the phone line so that people can't call for help. And other residents who live around them, they start noticing this really filthy and pungent smell from the apartment, smells of urine and feces, and everything about the environment is not conducive to what children required. And whenever they see the kids, they note that they always seem really anxious, really highly strung, really scared. And when the children are allowed out, which is very rare, Noor times them. And even though on one level they'd be desperate to get out of the house, they know that if they take too long, they're just going to be in for horrible punishment. And that doesn't last long. Eventually, she just stops them ever leaving the house. They just have this nucleus of this dysfunctional family. And also, no one else is allowed into the apartment. So they're in a scenario where the isolation is full and complete. And if, for example, one of the very few friends actually calls by, she would just tell that friend that they were grounded or sick. ultimately they just became fully at her mercy of their abuser 24/7. Now, as I've said, she had a particular predilection for harming certain children in the family. And at this point, Noor starts to really substantiate the abuse that goes towards Susan. So she starts to build that more and more again. Now, part of the reason for this is because Susan's become more rebellious. She was so bright. In school, she'd literally been a straight A grade student, which if you imagine the dysfunction we've been talking about, to be that clever and that conscientious in the face of such adversity, it's really unusual. And you just think about the potential this child had, a straight A grade student, in spite of those circumstances. But we know she's taken out of school, so she doesn't get to thrive in the way she deserved. But also imagine being that bright and knowing what you're living in. Being brighter than your mother and seeing what is happening within the dysfunction around you. That must have been torture for her psychologically. Even when she was getting those grades at school, Noor still interfered with the education, so she'd get her out of school and make her go shoplifting. So she'd send her to the local mall to get things. And if she was ever caught, Noor would just beat her up. Now, as Susan grows up, because she is very clever, because she can see that morally, ethically, and parentally, this is completely incorrect, she starts to take a stand against her mum. On one occasion, she actually runs away, but she's returned because she's in a carload full of people. And initially, they're there to go and collect belongings for her. So they're on her side. But chaos erupts and basically her brother gets into a fight. As we know, her eldest brother is kind of already complicit in this abuse because this is all he's known. This is his role. This is his job. And he reacts with violence with one of the lads in the car. So even though they essentially brought her to collect her belongings and take her with them, they leave her because they get scared. So Susan's now left by herself. Then there's another occasion. Susan manages to actually run away and she alerts the authorities about the abuse. And she gets placed in temporary care whilst the child services investigate. Now, this is absolutely tragic beyond belief because as we all know, this idea that an abusive parent will firstly be seen as abusive by the kids, that's a myth. Lots of children live with abusive parents and love them. And even though horrible things happen to them, they don't connect the dots. It takes years and years and years for them to recognise the trauma. But also, if children are terrified by an abuser, very few will speak out against them. So when you've only ever known this world, and people are investigating whether you should stay in that world, you haven't experienced any other. It's been normalised, the abuse. You're terrified of the perpetrator. Who are you going to side with? Yes, you should side with the authorities, tell them the truth, but the consequences could be dire. They could even be fatal for you. You've seen what this person is capable of. You don't know there's no other world out there where you could be free. You don't know whether there's another world out there where you could be safe. So often children will just stand up for the abuser. So they obviously do home visits to figure out whether what's being said about Noor is true. And she does end up in court on abuse allegations, but they come to nothing because every single one of the other children, they don't recognise it as abuse. And they're really scared, as I've said. So they basically tell the authorities that they've not been abused. And because of that, the charges are dropped and Susan is returned to Noor's custody, which is one of those decisions that just speaks volumes about how we fail to attend to young people in the way that we should. Listen, if a child is telling you that they are abused and they don't want to go home, to send that child home is something that is always going to be a real risk. Because if they're lying, well, there is something going on in the relationship between the child and the parent that needs to be resolved and is probably best resolved with them not living in the same place. But if they are telling the truth, albeit in the face of other people giving other information, you are sending them to the lion's den and you are putting them at grave risk of harm. And that is exactly what happens where Susan is concerned, because when she's returned, the abuse intensifies further. And of course it does, because just like in the suspected murder of her husband, she got away with it. So now Susan's a threat to her. The resentment is even bigger and she's outsmarted authorities again. She must have felt like she was a god in her world, that she could literally do anything and still get away with it. Now, there's a really severe beating that Susan endures, and at this point she actually manages to escape and she gets picked up by police. The consequence of that is that she ends up being put on a psychiatric ward. This is a child in distress dealing with the most horrific abuse. Her life is now seriously at risk because her abuser and her predator and perpetrator are enjoying the ability to just do whatever they want to this child without any consequences. She gets found by the police and just gets put in a mental health clinic because obviously the problem is with her. Of course it's not. We have a deeply traumatized child who's been violently abused for a hell of a lot of time. Now, she ends up telling the authorities about the abuse that she's suffered, but what does Noor do? She says, oh, it's all to do with her mental health, that she's just got mental health issues. She's psychiatrically unwell, so it's all BS. And they return that child back into her care. They basically take the nail, get the coffin, and hammer it in, because this genuinely is the last nail in the coffin for this child. And again, why they return her home just makes absolutely no sense to me at all, because there's no safeguarding there. This is repetitive behavior. This is a deeply unhappy child. This is somebody who's able to express to the authorities that they are scared and they are being abused, and yet they return her again. And as soon as she gets back, Noor puts on leather gloves because she doesn't want to show bruising, and she beats her severely. She then gets every other child in the household to join in. Why does she do that? Because she is giving Susan a direct message. You are the isolated one. You are the outsider. We are all on the same side. And that, again, is so abandoning for Susan. She also made them put on the gloves in turn and punch her in the stomach. And then she gags Susan and chains her to a bed each night. And the whole premise of that is she's letting her know, you're not escaping again. And she even got her siblings to keep an eye on her. So again, this has become a prison for Susan. Now, in my research, I'm going to say there are varying reports as to what plays out next. So some say that Noor temporarily unchained her while she was in the process of beating all the children. And apparently at this point, she gave her youngest daughter, Terry, a gun to point at her. However, allegedly, Terry got spooked when one of her siblings dropped a spoon on the floor, and that caused her to accidentally shoot Susan in the chest. So that's one account. But other reports suggest that there was an argument between Noor and Susan, and Noor actually purposely shot Susan. Now, hey, could have been an accident, but I'm just going to think about all the things that we've looked at so far, and I'm just going to throw it out there that my belief is that Noor's a majorly big liar, and Noor absolutely was the person who shot Susan. Because the idea of somebody dropping a spoon and you're just like, oh, I've just shot my sister, really doesn't register as real for me. But either way, whichever way it played out, Susan gets really badly injured. And of course, she's terrified. She says, please take me to the hospital. But Noor doesn't care about Susan in any way, shape or form. She's far more concerned at that moment in time that there is blood on the carpet. And I think when you consider a psyche and you consider the expected psyche of a mother, if ever we're going to see such dysfunction and juxtaposition between how you should act versus how you actually act, this plays out perfectly in this description. Why would you care about blood on the carpet when you have potentially mortally wounded a child of yours? But anyway, she refuses to let Susan go to the hospital, and she decides that she's going to treat the wound herself with the help of her children, because obviously what we didn't realise is all of her children have suddenly medically qualified. But again, can you imagine the trauma for those kids? Yes, they're living in this inhospitable reality with this horrific woman who's meant to be their mother and protector and is failing so massively, it's incomprehensible. But actually to drag them into the treatment of their really badly wounded sister, she has no care or consideration about the impact and trauma that she's creating on those kids. And putting Susan in the bath, that's just all about making sure that the blood doesn't cause any more stains. And that poor girl stays in that bath for nearly a month. And I have no idea at all how Susan manages to survive But she does. For nearly a month, she survives. Now, another row happens. Again, this is when Nora is in a completely inebriated state. She's full of alcohol. Nora actually throws a pair of scissors at Susan, and those scissors lodge in Susan's back. And at this point, Susan's just absolutely met that level of helplessness and hopelessness. And she just begs her mum, please let me leave. And bizarrely, Nora agrees. Now she says, listen, you can go, but there's a condition to that. Of course, there's a condition. Nora is obviously going to have a condition. She says, I need to remove the bullet that's in your back. Apparently, she didn't want any physical evidence of the abuse. I mean, just going to throw it out there. You know, a bullet wound, particularly one that's been left there for quite a while, even if you remove it, which is going to be physically very aggressive to do, there's still going to be evidential reality of a bullet wound being in there. I'm not splitting hairs here, but it just shows you the kind of psyche that this woman has. The idea that the evidence of abuse wouldn't be there because they removed the bullet. Susan, obviously, at this point, will literally agree to anything to escape. So she's given alcohol as an anaesthetic, and then Noor gets her son, Robert, to actually do the procedure using a box cutter. Can you imagine the agony? Now, he somehow, God only knows, manages to actually remove the bullet, but bear in mind, this is a very unsanitary environment. It's full of urine and feces. It's despicable, disgusting, it's pungent, etc. You can imagine how unsanitary the conditions are to carry out this kind of medical procedure in a completely unqualified way by a young person. And of course, in spite of the fact that she has survived all this time with this horrific bullet wound and had a pair of scissors lodged in her back, when they remove the bullet, it creates that open wound further and it becomes infected. And Susan develops sepsis. Now, for those of you who understand sepsis and blood poisoning, etc., it means that basically her entire system is going to fail. Her kidneys are going to go, her vital organs are all going to fail, and it's a horrible, gruesome death. So sepsis sets in at a stage for people who have sepsis with the right treatment and the antibiotics that are given, people can survive. But when it gets into those latter stages, it's absolutely lethal. And as we would expect in such a situation and scenario, she becomes delirious. She becomes critically ill. They just leave her on the floor. She's just left on the floor dying. And family members are just stepping over her to go where they need to go. And even at that point where her child is dying on the floor after going this horrendous home surgery, as opposed to getting her the help that she needs, they just ignore her. She actually told the other kids that Susan had been turned into a witch by Chester, her ex-husband, and that she'd put a curse on her, which is why, as a mother, she put on all this weight. So now she's isolating this child even further and making her out to be the devil incarnate, basically. Even claims she's been possessed by the devil and that's why she's sick. And she says to them, you know, there is a way that we can solve this. We just need to purge the demon with fire. On the 16th of July, 1984, she binds Susan's hands and feet and duct tapes her mouth. She got her sons to carry Susan and Susan's belongings to the car. They drove to Squaw Valley. This is where they piled the belongings by the side of the road and they dumped Susan on top of them. Noor then covered her daughter, who was alive, with petrol. And then she set her alight, left her to burn, and went home. She was 17 years old. The body was discovered the next day and it was said to still be smouldering. And when the autopsy was carried out, they were able to discover that she was alive when she was set on fire. In fact, the cause of death had been smoke inhalation. Obviously, they could also see that the body showed clear signs of abuse. Due to the extent of the burns, the only part of her body that wasn't burned was the left side of her face. She was basically completely unrecognizable. And that body would remain unidentified for nearly a decade. And here we have it again. Another crime that Noor has somehow inconceivably managed to get away with. You have to remember as well, she's involved her children in this death. That's very powerful. Because if you can make your kids feel culpable for these kind of killings, then they're going to be far less likely to tell the authorities because they're going to believe that they'll be implicated. So she's created this psychological torture and psychological prison that means that as opposed to them being enemies in this moment, she will see them more as allies because of them getting involved in the killing and the dumping of her daughter's body. Now, of course, because Susan's dead, she hasn't got that place to go with her resentment and aggression, has she? She needs another victim. She needs another participant that can fill that gap where she projects all of her vile, grotesque behaviour. And Sheila is the next in the line of fire. Now, at this point, Nora's got so many problems that she hasn't been working. So she's on unemployment benefits. She's really dissatisfied. She doesn't feel that she gets enough money whatsoever. She wants more from the state, can't get it. So she decides that the best way forward is she's going to get her 19-year-old daughter into prostitution. Bear in mind, that would be the last thing that any loving parent would wish to do. You don't put your child in a position of danger. And like it or otherwise, sex workers are put in the line of fire far more than the average individual because they meet people who sometimes are individuals without scruples and can do horrible things of a sexual and physical nature to the individuals that they're meeting up with. She's willingly sending her child out to do this. 19. Now, I would say, even though this is horrific and for Sheila, she deserves so much more. There is a silver lining because, of course, it means that she's finally allowed out of the house. And Nora initially is thrilled because she's getting all the money that her daughter actually makes. So, of course, there is an incentive to let her daughter come and go. But things don't ever stay quite the same for Nora, do they? She's always looking for the problem. And so she creates one. She becomes absolutely obsessed with a massive delusion and a massively irrational belief. And she decides that Sheila's pregnant and has an STD. So she makes it up in her head that she's got this sexually transmitted infection and she's also pregnant and is withholding that information. And then she decides that not only has she got this sexually transmitted infection, she's passed it on to her via the toilet seat. And that is something that is practically impossible. Sheila's confused. She's earning money. She's bringing home a decent living. She's giving her mother the economy that she's gone on about wanting. And she's blindsided because she doesn't connect why her mum is suddenly suggesting all these things that aren't true. And she denies the claims, of course, because they aren't true, but it just makes it worse. She's not complying. She's not agreeing with her perpetrator. And they don't like that. That means that she's trying to control reality as opposed to joining in with the delusion that her mother's created. So Nora, of course, intensifies the abuse. And the reason for that is she wants to break Sheila into confessing. So she beats Sheila severely. She hogtied her and then she locks her in a tiny closet. Bear in mind, in this closet, there was no ventilation. It was June, so temperatures were really high. She refused to give her any food, any drink, which is catastrophic. Okay, you can live without food, but without hydration, that is genuinely dicing with death. Or in this case, murder is as simple as that. Now, Sheila's younger sister, Terry, she goes ahead and manages to smuggle in some drink. But unfortunately, it's beer. That's the only house drink that they've got that's available. Now, of course, when you give somebody who's dehydrated beer, it further dehydrates that individual. And for Terry, the memories were horrific because she can remember Sheila just moaning and begging for help. In the end, Sheila just decides that the best way forward is to confess. Yes, I'm pregnant. Yes, I've passed on an STD for you. Yes, I agree with everything that you've said. But of course, by this point, Nora doesn't want an agreement. She's involved in the abuse. She wants retribution. She's enjoying that power. She's got the control back. How dare her child not tell her what she wanted to know, even though it wasn't true. So in spite of this admission by Sheila, she keeps her tied up and locked in the closet. On the third day, the 21st of June, 1985, The moans, the cries for help, the silence. Sheila had died. She was 20 years of age. Now, bear in mind, in spite of the silence, in spite of something clearly horrible happening, Noor doesn't open that closet door for a further 3 days. And of course, when she does, Sheila's dead. She finds her curled up in a fetal position. And the only reason that she opened that door was because the smell started to give it away, because the hot temperatures had started to decompose Sheila's body very, very quickly. And that's a problem, because she doesn't want anybody to be aware that her daughter has been murdered. So she wants to get rid of Sheila's body because she wants to make sure the smell doesn't incriminate her. Again, as far as she's concerned, she orders her two henchmen, her two sons, William and Robert, to help her dispose of it. When they try to remove Sheila's body from the wardrobe, it's literally stuck to the bottom of the closet. It's unbelievable that that is the state that girl was found in, oozing and weeping with decomposition to a point where it's literally physically difficult to remove her body from the inside of that closet. Ultimately, they dump her body in a cardboard box near Truckee Tahoe Airport. And as with Susan, when a body is actually found, authorities can't identify her. And just like with Susan, she became known as another Jane Doe. Now, back at the apartment, Noor's got an issue because she's now starting to think about the horrible smell. She's getting more paranoid that her criminal behaviour is going to be found out. And despite the fact that she's removed Sheila's body, that smell of decay lingers, and it does linger. It's why when police officers walk into a home where somebody has been killed and decomposed a little, they know. Don't even need to see a body. They can smell death. We are hardwired to do so. It's actually a protective mechanism. A lot of people eat meat. Those people who eat meat, they have a sense of smell. You don't really need a sell-by date on meat because you will literally be able to smell if it's going off. We know that our brains are wired to smell rotting meat in a way that really causes an aversion, and that protects us from doing things like eating food that will make us sick. And when it comes down to the human body, because of course the aversion to a human decay is going to be a massive, massive adverse reaction, that again is a protective mechanism, because essentially it means bad things have happened. Don't go too close. It's a protective reality. So it's something that is really profound when you smell it, and you never forget the smell. It's as simple as that. So she's really concerned that the neighbours are going to start alerting authorities, and she's had problems with the authorities. Yes, she's got away with it, but does she want any more of the light being shined on her potential deviance? Absolutely not. We get to September 1986. She decides that the best thing that she's going to do is to pack up the family's belongings, and she actually tells Terry, this is just how godlike she considers herself. She orders Terry to burn the whole apartment block down. Now, you just think about the impact on life there. She's willing to sacrifice all of her neighbours, their children, and so on and so forth, as long as she gets to get away with murder. So she has no care or consideration or concern for anybody else aside from herself, aside from her own liberty and freedom. Terry, of course, is going to do exactly what Mum says. So she empties 3 cans of lighter fluid in the apartment and she sets it on light. But neighbours, of course, they are quick to note that there is a problem. They spot the fire before it spreads. And fortunately, and thank God, the fire department are actually able to extinguish it. Now, interestingly, this seems like a real tipping point of change. So one of the sons that she had, Howard, he'd actually cut ties with the family several years earlier. So one child had actually made a run for it, so to speak. But now, after leaving the apartment, Noor's remaining children, they are finally able to escape her clutches. Even 16-year-old Terry, who managed to get Sheila's ID, she was able to escape and pass herself off as an adult. In fact, the only child that remained with his mum was 17-year-old Robert, and he and Noor moved into an apartment in Las Vegas, Nevada. But in 1991, Robert was actually convicted for shooting dead a bartender during a robbery. And this is just in keeping, isn't it, with his mother, because we've seen that she's shot dead people and she doesn't seem to have an issue with it. So, of course, her son has learnt that behaviour and it's no big deal to take life. This means that Noor's on her own for the first time in her life, and she ends up moving to Salt Lake City, Utah. And it's several years after this that Terry makes that decision to walk into a police station and report her mother's crimes. Now, as I said, it took three goes before people took her seriously. But the point is, she stood in truth. She stood for the legacy of her dead sisters, and she was willing to make her mother come and serve the justice that she deserved, to receive what she was absolutely in line to receive. Now, as noted, the investigators find Susan and Sheila's body, and they identify that body. And even though this is nearly a decade after their murders, I have a suspicion that Noor would have been haunted by their girls every single day of her life. I genuinely do. I think it would have become bigger and bigger in her conscience, not because she has a conscience about caring for the kids that she stole, the lives that she murdered, more that she would be somebody who felt that her own liberty and freedom was under threat. And that would really affect her day in and day out. So yes, it wouldn't be the haunting that the girls had been murdered by her. It would be the haunting that the girls were going to track her down one way or another and bring her to justice. Now, it is unbelievable where the authorities found her, because when they actually came across her and discovered what she was doing for a job, it turned out that she wasn't doing something like working at an abattoir, slitting animals' throats, or I don't know, working in a scenario with refuge and sewage where she actually had a soul comparable to the stench of that particular environment. No, that's not the case. She was actually working as a carer for her landlord's elderly mother. I can imagine how the interview went. Could you just tell us about your attributes? You know, what skills you're going to bring to the job? Well, I'm very caring. I've consistently cared for many men during multiple marriages. So that's one for me. I'm adept with tools. I've been very good at educating people with a range of tools. I'm an individual who's excellent at knowing how to dispose of things that need disposing of, so I'm good with shopping and with refuse. And I'm an individual who feels that my nurture is of a level that's very different to anyone else's nurture level at all. Oh, that sounds great. You can start Monday. Do you know what I mean? Literally, could you imagine being the landlord and saying, what? She's what? She did what? And I dread to think what was happening to that elderly mother, because a leopard can't change the spots in this way. Simple as. You know, she's got a job. There's no way she's not going to be abusive at times to that person. So they find her in November 1993. She ends up getting charged with her daughter's murders. And also she gets charged with two counts of conspiracy to commit murder and two special circumstances charges, multiple murder and murder by torture, which are all absolutely correct. Now, Robert, bear in mind, who has shot the bartender, he's still serving his 16-year sentence for that shooting. He also gets charged with his sister's two murders, as did his older brother, William. He helped them dispose of the bodies, so you can understand why those charges were put in. Now, in exchange for testifying against his mother, the murder charges against Robert were dropped, which, again, people may think that that's not appropriate. I guess that we have to think about the life that Robert had lived. He was essentially a prisoner in that home as much as anybody else was. And the scars have obviously ran deep. It doesn't justify any of his behaviour, but I don't think we can see him in the context that we'd seen Noor. And I can understand that the state just want to make sure that this woman is brought to justice full stop. Noor had, of course, initially pled not guilty. I do not know why these individuals' brains do not kick into gear. I mean, Obviously, she's guilty. On top of this, yes, we can see that in her prior history, she's got away with murder literally, and therefore she has an arrogance and superiority that makes her feel, well, I'll just say I'm not guilty. But at the end of the day, she's going to soon discover that Robert's testifying against her. And in that moment, she decides, well, bang to rights. There's no way I'm going to get away with this. And she wants to get a sentence that is not going to mean that she is put to death, because she's a major narcissist, isn't she? She doesn't want anybody else to control her demise. Only she can control that. So she changes the plea at this point. And of course, that means that she does indeed avoid the death penalty, which some of you will think is inappropriate anyway. And some of you will think she doesn't have a right to do that. At the end of the day, her actions are still her actions. And if they meet the standard of the death penalty, then maybe that's where she should go. Now, Noor's son, William, who's also charged, he gets sentenced to probation and counselling for his part in the sister's killings. And I genuinely think that that's the right attitude that the state have, that at the end of the day, we're talking about horrifically traumatised and abused individuals. And whilst we want the wrath and we want the retribution for these girls who've been horribly murdered, and even for the husband that got shot earlier on, we can't forget about him. We always want to have justice for these individuals. But where the girls are concerned and the boys have been involved in their murders, they were also in a torturous, abusive situation, and it was live or die without a doubt for them. So arguably, siding with a predator in a moment where they felt the repercussions for them could have been lethal otherwise, it makes sense that they didn't come down and want them put in prison for the rest of their lives. Now, Robert, he's convicted of being an accessory after the fact. So he gets sentenced to 3 years to run concurrently with his existing sentence. So you can see that they were very sympathetic and empathetic to Robert and William. And like I said, we can't excuse their behaviour because there is always a choice. But arguably, we can understand the reasoning that led them to involve themselves in these tragic and terrible situations. The person who is to blame fully is Noor. And Noor doesn't get the death sentence because she avoids it by pleading guilty, but she does get 2 consecutive life terms. So she currently remains incarcerated at the California Institute for Women. She's 77 years old, and she'll actually be eligible for parole in 2027. That's when she's 80. But hopefully she's never going to get released, because the parole board are likely, I imagine, to turn her down. But also, you know, things can happen within those years. She's getting on a bit. Let's just hope that she takes her last breath in a prison cell and is carried out in a box, which is literally the least that she deserves. At least she's been afforded food, water, safety to some degree. At least she's been able to read books, learn new things, have friendships, and all the things that you get in prison. Unlike the children that she denied all of those things to at times, with respect, her punishment is far less than the punishment that she bestowed on those 2 girls and the prison that she created for all of her children living with the trauma. At the end of the day, the only thing that keeps me warm in my heart is knowing that the moment that she takes her last breath, there's gonna be the hell train ready to pick her up, take her down, and let her burn for eternity. And eternity is a very, very long time. Very, very, very long time. And let's hope that the devil is pretty inventive, and I don't know, has an education paddleboard and also a very hot cupboard that she can, you know, see how she feels fitting in there. Just throwing it out there. It eases my sense of justice when I imagine such kind of fantastical things playing out in reality. Now, Terry Noor, of course, the hero in this story, with respect, who wouldn't let her sisters die in vain, she ended up settling down with her second husband in Utah, and she was apparently always just haunted by her mother's abuse. But in spite of that, she did actually manage to create a happy life for herself. But what's really sad is that life was short-lived. She died in 2011. She was just 41 years of age. But thankfully, those last years were happy years. And even though they certainly weren't long enough, I feel that being reunited with her sisters and them being able to acknowledge the part that she played in having justice served That is something that I believe when she took her last breath would ease her conscience. She was a horrendously abused victim herself, but in spite of that, she had the courage, she had the virtue, she had the love for her sisters enough to mean that that mother, that murdering woman, never got to walk our streets again, never got to kill another person. And we have her to thank for that. What do you think of this case, guys? It is so hard to imagine a mum wanting to do the things that I've talked about where Teresa Knorr is concerned, and yet she seemed to do it with absolute ease. In fact, I would say she did it with absolute enjoyment. She loved being powerful. She loved harming those that she should have been there to protect and love. And she fed off the fear of the most vulnerable, her own children. Like I said, I don't think she got her comeuppance. I think that's still to come. Give me a comment, let me know your thoughts, and I will see you again next time. It's been one of those cases where it just makes you shake your head and think, how did these human beings get gifted these beautiful children only to destroy them in the most despicable of ways? See you again next time. Bye, be safe.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.